Welcome to Conjuncture. My name is Jordan Camp. I'm really delighted to be here with Ayaz Malik. Ayaz is a lecturer in human geography at the University of Liverpool. His research focuses on Marxist and post-colonial theory, and he also particularly specializes on labor and social movements and urban politics in Pakistan and the Global South. He's published in a wide variety of venues, Antipode, Historical Materialism, Studies in Political Economy. His work appears in popular venues, Jacobin, Navarra Media, and beyond. I'm really pleased to be with Ayaz today at the Howard Zinn Book Festival here in San Francisco to talk about his work on imperialism and the challenges for political and social movements in Pakistan and the Global South. So thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me, Ayaz. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jordan, for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's start in Pakistan. You know, you've written in Jacobin and elsewhere, using Antonio Gramsci's writings to understand the conjuncture, let's call it the Pakistan situation. So why turn to Gramsci to understand the situation there, and what does it reveal?
Gramsci is extremely important to think about present moments in a complex way, right? That the present moment is not simply homogeneous, or it's not simply what it seems, it's not simple, but the present moment or the conjunctural moment is kind of what we would call an intertwining of multiple historical times, right? Of multiple forces of different kind of temporal varieties, different kind of temporal rhythms, right? And in that he distinguishes between two types of trends, two types of patterns, two types of rhythms, right? He says that there are organic trends and organic rhythms, and there are conjunctural or punctual rhythms, or punctual moments, right? Organic are the more kind of long-term, long-dury kind of forces which are acting in this kind of longer historical duration. Conjunctural are the more punctual moments, which then, you know, articulate or bring together these kinds of forces and relations and processes of different temporal durations, right? So for example, I mean, if we can work with an example to be more concrete about it, when Gramsci talks about fascism, right, he relates fascism and that conjuncture to both the proximate crisis of the Italian ruling bloc after the post-World War I, you know, moment with the labor insurgency and so on and so forth, but also then to medium-term and long-term forces, right? So he relates them to the medium-term of the incoherences of Italian state formation, right? And the issues that related to that in terms of North-South relations, peasant, urban-rural relations. And then he also recasts that moment in much longer historical rhythms, right? So the kind of medieval communes in Italy and what those tell us about urban-rural relations, the relationship between the church and society and so on and so forth. So proximate, medium, long-term, these processes of different temporal rhythms are brought together in this one moment to produce fascism. Right. Similarly, Stuart Hall, right? He talks about Thatcherism as regressive modernization, authoritarian populism, which relates to both post-World War, the 70s, 80s moment in Britain, but also the medium-term crisis of British imperialism, starts from arguably from the late 19th century onwards, but also to what Tom Nyan is talking about in terms of, you know, the long-term incoherences of an incomplete bourgeois revolution in Britain and its first mover advantage and disadvantage. So Hall almost conjuncturalizes Tom Nyan in that moment. So that's how we think of the conjuncture, right? That's how we need to think about politics, you know, in Pakistan and elsewhere, that the present moment is not simply homogeneous with itself, it's not identical with itself, but is actually fractured and about bringing these multiple kind of temporal rhythms together in that particular moment. And in Pakistan's case, that's absolutely fundamental, because if you have to understand the contradictory kind of impulses embodied in Imran Khan phenomenon, you have to understand both the kind of proximate kind of, you know, 10, 20 year period in which Imran Khan emerges, but also the long-term crisis, or what I would call the organic crisis of the Pakistani ruling bloc, which has been going on for at least half a century and arguably since independence, right? And that long-term crisis is basically the Pakistani ruling bloc's lack of what Gramsci would call a hegemonic project. Fundamentally, the lack of a coherent socio-economic project which can create concessions and agreement within fractions of the ruling class while also giving concessions to those below for a sustainable hegemonic project. And because the Pakistani ruling class has not had that for at least half a century, they have been fundamentally dependent on imperialism for their coherence. And as the imperial salve of the Pakistani ruling formation, ruling bloc, has fallen off over the last 10, 15 years after the winding down of the war on terror, we see recurrent crises, recurrent punctual crises, which themselves are, you know, kind of conjunctural, punctual manifestations of this long-term organic crisis of the Pakistani ruling bloc. And these multiple forces are coming together in the person of Imran Khan. And that's why it's such a contradictory and hard thing to understand, but also very important. And it becomes important to understand the conjuncture as this confluence of multiple temporal rhythms, organic and punctual moments, because it's important for politics, right? Because if you think every crisis is an organic crisis, and that's what Gramsci would call ideologism, right? Or voluntarism, that, you know, this is the moment for revolution. Or if you think that no crisis is important, and every crisis, that nothing touches the structure or organic moment, or every crisis is self-contained, then this leads to fatalism. So reading the conjuncture, reading the relationship between conjuncture and organic is fundamental for politics and for good analysis.
Yeah, thanks for this, Ayaz. I mean, let's talk about imperialism for a second. I mean, the recent paper you delivered at Historical Materialism in London kind of asked the question about how imperialism does and doesn't condition politics in Pakistan. And one of the things you detail there is how some anti-imperialists have kind of sympathized with Imran Khan's, a right-wing populist's, claims of being a victim of imperialism. And you say, you know, actually, we need to have a more sober discussion, one that, and I'm quoting you here, to set the debates on concrete and historicized grounds. So what's at stake in thinking about imperialism on concrete and historicized grounds? And can you help us understand the debate?
Yeah, sure. Look, there are two things, right? One is the liberal understanding, which is a denial of imperialism in total, right? That somehow there is this world system where countries and social formations are integrated in unequal ways, hierarchical ways. So there's a denial of that, which is kind of modernization theory and so on. So we don't bother with that. That's not important. The other thing is more crude kind of anti or self-proclaimed anti-imperialist analysis, which basically end up focusing on personalities and policies. Now the issue is that you go and read Lenin, and one of the things that Lenin says to Kautsky in that famous pamphlet on imperialism is that imperialism is not a policy. It's a structure. It's a tendency built into capitalism and its expansion. So by reducing imperialism or anti-imperialism to personalities, what basically you're doing is that you are replacing rhetoric for politics, right? You're not focusing on the program. Basically what someone says, right, or what someone proclaims to say or believe comes to stand in for politics. You replace class politics for geopolitics, in a sense. And that's a failing endeavor, right? Because, I mean, look, Marx tells us, and this is from the German ideology, that, you know, we don't start with what people say about themselves. We start with the social relations that they're embedded in, and then from there we understand what people are saying, right? That is the basics of Marxist analysis, right? So let's do some Marxist analysis to understand, not just stay at the level of what someone is saying, that might be Imran Khan or someone else, it doesn't matter. But actually, what are the social relations? What are the wider programs or lack thereof, which then condition, what is the total analysis, which then conditions what people are saying or not saying, right? And in that way, once we start looking at, you know, as I said, the organic crisis of the Pakistani ruling bloc is the fact that they don't have an integral hegemonic project. They are fundamentally, congenitally dependent on imperialism. And as that salve has fallen off after the world war on terror, you know, for the last 30, 40, 50 years, Pakistani ruling bloc has basically served as the regional gendarmerie of American imperialism. And since the end of the world, as the war on terror starts winding down, during which Pakistan gets over $30 billion of aid from America to facilitate the assault on Afghanistan, that has been going down since the late 2000s and 2010s. That's when we see the rise of Imran Khan, right? So we have this organic crisis, dependence on imperialism, narrow social basis of the ruling bloc, and then the proximate issues where a new middle class is emerging, it's finding discontent, it is discontent, and it's finding articulation to Imran Khan against this crisis within the ruling bloc itself. So what we need to have for a concrete understanding of imperialism is not simply a focus on personalities, but have understanding of, okay, how are these organic and conjunctural moments coming together, right? What are the mediums of dependency or media of dependency through which a country, a ruling, a social formation is incorporated into an unequal world system? And so we will be looking at things like, instead of rhetoric and you know, discourse, we are looking at things like, you know, patterns of investment, patterns of debt, right? Patterns of unequal exchange and dependency, right? Now, if we start looking at those in terms of with regards to Pakistan, we see that actually there is no difference between the Imran Khan interregnum, or like, you know, 3-4 years of rule before, and what came before him. In fact, a lot of the tendencies which were already building up in the previous governments in Pakistan were radicalized during Imran Khan era, right? So since the early 2010s, there is an increasing trend of a decreasing of bilateral debt for Pakistan, in terms of its foreign debt, and an increase in lending from private commercial creditors, which has much more onerous loans. What happens in Imran Khan era? Again, the trend is upwards for private commercial loans, right? Similarly, with debt servicing, you are paying so much to private commercial lenders in terms of interest and debt payments that there is no fiscal space to spend on development and so on and so forth. The Imran Khan era, they get a respite during COVID, because during COVID, for a lot of third world countries, debt payments are suspended, right? That's a lucky respite, right? And as soon as those debt payments come back, the regime falls into crisis again. Right? During COVID, you know, Imran Khan's ministers are coming on Twitter and boasting that corporate profits are up by 65-69%. I mean, this is a vast and organized scam, you know, upward distribution of wealth, right? So where is the anti-imperialist program here? Like, these are the media of dependency of Pakistan through the military, through debt, through certain patterns of investment where countries are investing, America, China, Gulf countries, they're investing in non-productive sectors. They're investing in what we call tertiary sectors. They're not investing in manufacturing, which would create, you know, at least theoretically, it would create stable and long-term jobs. Even in manufacturing, when they are investing, they're investing in consumer goods, not in capital and production goods, which can potentially become the node of sustainable industrialization. So if the patterns are the same, right, the media of dependency to the world imperial system don't change, then where is the anti-imperialism here? There is no land reforms, right? There is no way of cutting the power of the monopolies. In fact, as I just gave the example of the corporate profits, the monopolies have a field day during Imran Khan government, right? So, I mean, this is the kind of concrete, when you say concrete and historicized, we have to understand imperialism, this is what we have to do. We have to look at the trends of the ruling bloc, the incoherences, the concrete ways and media through which they are dependent, and then what happens during the period that we are looking at, right? Because otherwise, if you're not looking at programs, if you're not looking at these wider structural, organic, conjunctural trends, what are you looking at? You're looking for the next self-proclaimed hero, self-proclaimed wronged hero. It's a total abdication of responsibility. You're not doing any organizing. You're not doing any solidarity with the workers and the peasants and the women and the students who are struggling. It's not politics, and it's not an analysis. It's, you know, what is it? I don't even know what to call it. I mean, you can call it clapping from the midst of crowds, right? This is not politics. You don't organize. You have no engagement with the history or the politics or the economics of a country. And all you're doing is going on rhetoric. So it's clapping from the midst of crowds. It's not serious Marxist analysis.
Well, could you say a little more about this? I mean, one, I'm compelled, and maybe we can come back to the difference between class analysis and geopolitical analysis. But other, if you could just, you know, maybe say a word more about China's role in this debt situation in Pakistan.
Sure. Look, China's role, we have to have a sober discussion here, right? On the one hand, there is this Cold War propaganda by the likes of the Economists and the Financial Times, that China is somehow the new East India Company, or it is you know, in Africa, it's doing debt bondage and debt diplomacy and so on. Again, this is completely overblown. People who are doing serious research, like the Johns Hopkins Centers on China-Africa kind of investment, there's no such thing as a debt trap or debt diplomacy. Chinese loans are very similar to Western loans, or the traditional core countries' loans. In some cases, the interest rates are higher, right? So that's a problem. But the issue is, in Pakistan's case, yes, China's proportion of Pakistan's foreign debt has been increasing. It's now the single largest bilateral creditor to Pakistan. However, its credit to Pakistan is still less than the multilateral institutions. So IMF, World Bank, Asian Development Bank, and so on and so forth. So again, let's have a sober discussion about this. What is in fact much more problematic, right? is that Pakistan's debt to private commercial lenders has been increasing, right? So Pakistan's debt to private commercial lenders right now is almost exactly the same level as Chinese debt. It's about 20% of total debt. But even while the private commercial lender debt is 20% of the total debt stock, the interest and service payments that Pakistan does is 60% of the total to private commercial lenders. So it's disproportionately the money is going to private commercial lenders and banks. A lot of them are Western banks. And I'm not saying China is not a player here. We're paying onerous loans to China as well. And Chinese patterns of investment have been non-productive. As I said, they've been in tertiary sectors, energy generation, transport, communication, telecommunications, and financial services. So not generating industrial development or, you know, sustainable, any kind of semblance of sustainable developmentalism as we used to have at one point. So yes, absolutely, Chinese patterns of investment have to be studied and critiqued. And Chinese patterns of debt have to be seriously studied and critiqued, but they have to be placed into context, right? Neither is China going to be the next anti-imperialist leader or some herald of a new kind of, you know, anti-imperialist third worldist node, nor is it an East India company, right? It is a rapidly kind of capitalizing or capitalist, rising capitalist power with its own specific form of capitalism, which has its own issues in terms of spatial fix, in terms of overproduction and, you know, investment, which is being trying to be solved through the BRI and so on, to the Belt and Road Initiative. But it's not the East India Company. It is developing now, the analysis is showing, it is developing some kind of, you know, imperializing role with regards to smaller countries like Pakistan and different parts of Africa. But in terms of the historical long durée, it's nowhere near close to, in terms of magnitude, its mechanisms, to what the Western core countries have been doing for the last two centuries. So again, it's still an unequal relationship with China, and a sober discussion needs to be had. But sober discussion needs to be had about debt with multilateral institutions, with private commercial banks. And again, about imperialism as a structure, rather than, you know, simply personalities or this or that country and so on and so forth. That, you know, what is important, again, if you look at Chinese investment in Pakistan in concrete terms, right? So I've already told about the sectoral patterns, that it's not in sustainable or employment generating sectors. But also for those of us, for those of our comrades who think of China as some, you know, big anti-imperialist power, let's look at concretely what these projects are doing in Pakistan. They are causing displacement, they are causing dispossession, they are causing all kinds of environmental degradation and ecological destruction. So if there is an anti-imperialist project here, if there is a pro-people project here, I would really like to see it, right? Again, this is part of having a sober discussion about imperialism. Again, as I said, China is not the biggest thing here. It's still the historical core countries. But again, let's have a sober discussion about China as well, both in terms of the macroeconomics of it, but also concretely how these things hit the ground. If there is a pro-people project there, I would love to have a pro-people project which is, you know, sponsored by, you know, the biggest revolution the world has ever seen, or the legacies of the biggest revolution the world has ever seen. It's just that it's not there. So we have to have our analysis based on reality rather than hope in this case.
Yeah, thanks for this. And I hope you'll publish this paper that you delivered at Historical Materialism. If you do, we'll be sure to circulate it, and perhaps we could have you back to talk about that. But while I have you here, I want to talk about how to think about the relationship between the Global South and the situation as you've laid it out there, the conjuncture, the situation with imperialism in relationship to the situation in the Global North. You know, you and Stefan Kipfer, a geographer, have co-authored an essay, you know, linking Gramsci and Fanon, stretching and translating, as you put it, to do, you know, just that. You say, bringing Gramsci in dialogue with Fanon enables us to, and I'm quoting you and Kipfer, quote, you know, treat the Global South and imperial heartlands relationally. So what do you mean by this? Why is it important to analyze struggles in the Global South and Global North relationally? And what do you mean in the essay by a Gramsci-Fanon convergence?
All right, okay. Well, I mean, the Gramsci-Fanon convergence is at multiple levels. And fundamentally, there's a fundamental epistemological convergence between the two revolutionaries and thinkers, right? And the fundamental epistemological convergence is in the fact of how they conceive the relationship between truth and human practice, right? Truth and organized political practice. So both of them, they They do not eschew truth for a complete indeterminacy, but they also don't have ahistorical conceptions of truth. For them, truth is fundamentally related to what human beings do in an organized manner. So there is a historical truth, there are humanistic truths, which can, and because they're historical, they can be changed, right? And that also, you know, relates to what you were saying in terms of treating things and processes relationally, right? That anything that seems to be a thing, any process which seems to be stable, which seems to be solidified, you know, that might be, you know, things like race, right? That might be abstractions or, you know, designations of East and West. These are all fundamentally relations. They are all fundamentally historical and social creations, which need to be traced back to their historical and social coordinates, and often to the kind of organized socioeconomic interests that they are an expression of, right? So, I mean, I can give you the example we can use is, you know, for example, you know, Gramsci's concept of the subaltern, right? I mean, widely taken up in social theory, in political practice, but often misunderstood, the subaltern, as somehow this outside of modernity, right? As somehow, you know, this exclusion from the usual rhythms of the bourgeois state, right? Somehow this excluded fragment, right? This, you know, metonym for, you know, being an outside to bourgeois modernity, right? Which is not the case. When Gramsci talks about the subaltern, he talks about them in a relational manner, right? The subaltern are differentiated. They are always existing in relation to existing ruling blocs, right? They are existing in relation to the differentiations within themselves, right? So along class and gender and regional, racial, ethnic, occupational lines, right, for example. And therefore, because they are in a relational kind of situation with the ruling class or with the ruling bloc, there is always the potential for them, for their organization to become more coherent, more homogeneous, and then, you know, form an alternative ruling bloc or alternative hegemony in that sense. So again, subalternity is a relational concept, right? Rather than it's a relation rather than a condition as such. It's a process almost in that sense. So that would be, you know, subalternity. Similarly with Fanon, right? I mean, for example, take something like the, you know, that chapter on the fact of blackness, right? Blackness is not something natural, is not something ontological. Even if it seems natural, even if it seems ontological, what Gramsci and Fanon especially are telling us is to go beneath what seems stable and look at things like processes, look at things as relations, right? Look at things as networks of or nodes of relations, right? Because that is the only way to denaturalize things. And because once we, and also then to understand what kind of human practice, what specific forms of organized human practice make something which is always dynamic, which is always relational, which is always a node, make that kind of, those kinds of nodes of relations look stable. They make them take on the appearance of ontological fixity, right? Now, once you start breaking up ontological fixity into networks of relations, into nodes, into multiple mediations, what you're then looking at is, you know, what we would call articulation, right? Okay, what are the different networks and nodes of relations which come into making a conjuncture or a particular moment or a particular relation which seems fixed, like blackness or race? And only because what seems fixed is always a product of multiple relations, of multiple temporal rhythms, multiple social kind of interests and political and spatial rhythms, once we start delineating those relations, then we can see, okay, how do we break this up, right? If blackness seems like a fact, right, but if we then relationalize it, if we deontologize it, if we socialize it and historicize it, and if we see what kind of relations go into making it up, then we can also make a sober assessment, okay, where is the contradiction in more classical language, right? What are the joints and contradictions through which we can unmake one relation into a more emancipatory and liberatory forms? So, you know, those are the kind of stakes which are there in thinking about things, about processes, about spaces in relational terms, because that's the only way to denaturalize what seems natural, to socialize what seems ontological. And if things are taken as natural or ontological, that's automatically a closing off of politics.
One of the things that you suggest is that reading Gramsci with Fanon is to globalize Gramsci. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, Gramsci himself is always talking about in relational terms, right? He's talking in comparative terms all the time. He's comparing Fordism and fascism. He's comparing pre-colonial Islamic or Muslim civilizations with, you know, what later on comes to be Europe in urban-rural relations and so on and so forth. So there's a relationalizing or comparative impulse in Gramsci himself, right? That is what then leads us to, you know, put him in conversation with other thinkers, right? And one of them is Frantz Fanon, right? And why Fanon becomes important is that because he comes from an actively and directly colonial situation rather than compared to Gramsci, which is an arguably semi-colonial situation, and Fanon, of course, as he, from his positionality as a black man and so on and so forth, he has a much more attuned understanding of what I call the density of immediacy, right? That, you know, he has a much more attuned understanding of, you know, the density, the viscerality of subjective experience, and how, again, the fact of blackness in this case, right? And how that needs to be contended with, right? So it's epistemologically similar to Gramsci, but in some ways he kind of radicalizes Gramsci, Marx, and Hegel on the question of dialectics, on the question of immediacy, and on the question of the relationship between the subjective and the objective, right? And what Fanon tells is that we have to take the moment of race, right, or the moment of subjective experience or sensuous experiences in this case very, very seriously. But again, he doesn't stop there, right? Like Gramsci, like others, he's a quintessentially modern thinker. So he takes the subjective experience, the in this case, that of race, or it might be something else, very, very seriously. And he dives into that particularity, but always with the aim of changing and revolutionizing social reality at multiple levels. So from the level of the self itself, to things like everyday life, to language, to urban-rural relations, to the state, of course, and up to the international. So like Gramsci, Fanon is a modern thinker that he's looking at social life in this totalizing manner, in a multi-level manner. But where Gramsci Fanon is important is to deal with the very viscerality, with the very granularity of how imperialism works at multiple levels, including at the level of the body, right? And also then stretching Gramsci. Well, you know, Fanon says we have to stretch Marxism, so stretching Gramsci towards the study of, you know, social formations, colonized and post-colonial, in terms of, okay, how do they differ in terms of their patterns of social, spatial kind of evolution, their patterns of class formation, the revolutionary subject in these cases, right? How do limited, and because their post-colonial formations are inserted into imperialism in a certain way, as I showed with Pakistan, because of the limited capacities in terms of hegemonic projects, in terms of socio-economic projects, how then that is then compensated through what we would call a hypertrophy of ideological and cultural articulations, right? Cultural conservatism or religiosity, right? Or Bonapartism in terms of dictatorship and authoritarianism, right? So why Fanon is important is that, you know, he's placing all of these, you know, things like, you know, ideological hyperbole, authoritarianism, Bonapartism, fascism, in their concrete, historicized, and in this case, imperial contexts. And as a result, you know, he kind of denaturalizes this understanding that, you know, dictatorship, authoritarianism is, you know, something just black people do or something that brown people do, right? It's not that. It's because of the way imperialism shapes and conditions the social formation and then narrowness of the ruling blocks therein that then, you know, leads to certain kinds of conditioning of the political terrain and also kind of related and attendant kind of ideological articulation. So he says that, you know, when the national bourgeoisie talks about Africanization, be very careful. Because often, not all the time, often this is the ideology of a defensive national bourgeoisie, right? So again, you know, the previous point that, and this is what Himani Banerjee says, that we have to decongeal civilizational abstractions. Right? So these big discourses, we are Western civilization, or we are Islamic civilization, or this is African civilization. Let's go under the mediations of these and see how this is related to history, to often limited hegemonic projects.
Yeah, I mean, you say you have to attempt to refuse what's very difficult to refuse, and that is the naturalization of race and racism.
Yeah.
A very important task. Let me ask one other question about Fanon. You know, there's been an uptick in interest with him, with some urgency, the urgency of immediacy with the siege on Gaza.
Sure.
I want to ask you, you know, about this argument that you make with Kipfer about how we might be able to stretch Fanon, you know, and in doing so, understand this siege with the kind of specificity that the conjuncture requires.
Sure. Look, I mean, I'm not an expert on Palestinian issues or history. This is not my area. I think people should be reading our Palestinian comrades, listening to what they're saying. There's a lot of great literature on Palestinian political economy, on Israeli settler occupation, settlerism, and so on. So I would defer on this issue to them. I can make some general comments, right? In terms of the civilizational abstraction, again, the point is to not take, you know, this as some, and this is an obvious point, not take this as some kind of transhistorical clash between civilizations, but again, place it in the concrete historical, you know, and visceral context in which we are living in terms of Gaza and Palestine, right? The 70 years of occupation, the kind of everyday humiliation, the last 15 years of economic strangulation, and so on and so forth, right? This is the context through which we can dehistoricize and concretely understand rather than, you know, oh, Muslims just hate Jews, right? I mean, that's just ridiculous, of course, and historically ignorant, number one. Number two, I can make a comment on this question of violence and Fanon, right? I mean, people talk, take this uptake of Fanon as a theorist of violence. It's a partial reading, which doesn't mean that Fanon is some kind of pacifist, right? He's not squeamish about violence, but his views on violence are also very complex, right? So if you go read through to the end of The Wretched of the Earth, the last chapter is all about the disorders of colonial and anti-colonial violence, right? And for him, the important point is not violence per se. He's a political and revolutionary thinker, right? And he has this wonderful line in the second chapter of The Wretched, where he says that it's not violence per se which is important, but it's the knowledge of the practice of action. Right? So it's not that violence or killing people, and again, not being squeamish about that in terms of, but the strategic kind of wider, is it helping raise consciousness? It is helping raise consciousness of the task at hand. Is it linked to a wider program? This is the question, right? He says repeatedly that the point is not, yes, violence, but the question is there's a necessity to totalize the event. Those are the words that he uses, right? So violence, if there is need for violence in that situation, it has to be part of a wider program. And I'll give you one reason as to why the issue of, because political education is what everything runs around. It's the fulcrum for Fanon for a wider transformation, not violence per se. So because you can't beat the colonizer at violence. The military might, they are much bigger than you, right? They're funded by the greatest military machine the world has ever seen, right? Gramsci says this, that you can't defeat colonizers at the paper yesterday about that. You can't defeat them at the technical military level, but at the political military level. And the political military level includes fundamentally political education, mass struggle, consciousness raising, and consciousness of the program that we will have. And it's important to look at this from the other side, right? Which is that we have this situation in Gaza and other places where people who, you know, and I'm talking about Jewish people, and specifically Zionist Jews, people who've undergone one of the worst massacres in modernity, right? Two, three generations down the line, the Zionist or right-wing Zionist Jews, you know, that kind of generations of them, are now themselves perpetrating one of the most brutal, probably the most brutal colonial occupation of our time, right? So what does that tell us? What that tells us, number one, is that oppression does not create noble subjects. Right? Oppression creates brutalized subjects, right? And what is important is not that oppression, I mean, of course, oppression is very important, but what is important is political education, right? That we can't assume that simply because someone is oppressed and whatever they're doing will be right, right? The importance is of political education. Violence, sure, if that is what is required for anti-colonial thing, sure, but the issue is the necessity to totalize the event, the necessity for the knowledge of the practice of action. And that is something which can be demonstrated and understood not by looking at what Palestinian comrades are doing, but actually what is happening from the other side. Oppression, subjugation, this is a point of my friend and comrade Arshad Sabji made, and Enzo Traverso also makes. They don't create noble subjects. What does create revolutionary subjects, what does create sustainable programmatic change is political education. And that's what we need to be thinking about when we're thinking about Fanon and Palestine and so on.
Yeah, just a word, the paper you mentioned is from my colleague Jennifer Greenberg and co-author, who we'd written the essay in Antipode together and has a terrific new book and is running a project at Cost of War at Brown. Ayaz, I could talk to you all day. I'm mindful we're here at the Zen Festival. We have, you know, multiple panels today. We're going to be on a panel later with Jillian Hart and Marcus Green, the Secretary of the International Gramsci Society, and Jill is at Berkeley. In like a minute, is there anything that I haven't asked that you would like to add?
No, I think we've been very comprehensive, very.
Ayaz Malik, it's been a pleasure to have you on Conjuncture.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. And to our viewers and listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. Stay tuned.